You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Justice Stephen Breyer officially announced his retirement from the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. President Joe Biden reiterated a promise to replace Breyer with a black woman talking yesterday.
While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view.
Breyer's replacement would join a court that currently has a conservative majority of 6-3. We're talking about Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement, what it means for the future of the Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Justice Breyer's decision to retire and to announce it this week? Do you think it was the right move? What are you hoping to see in the replacement process? What are your thoughts on the direction the court has moved in recent years? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are there particular issues that are before the court or that might come before the court that you are particularly concerned about? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy King is a professor and interim chair of the Political Science Department at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Always good to be on public radio.
Can you talk about the timing of Justice Breyer's retirement announcement and his planned retirement date?
It's actually not so unexpected, given the age of Justice Breyer and the fact that typically when you look in the past at Supreme Court justices, they typically try to retire under the administration of, if it's the same party of the president that appointed them. And given President Biden's slumping public approval ratings, given the fact that he has struggled with getting his agenda off the ground for public policy, it's a recognition that if he's going to make this move, he needs to do it now.
Justice Breyer, among all the justices, has made the case pretty prominently that we shouldn't think of justices as political or thinking about these succession issues and things like that. And yet you think this was on his mind?
It's on every justice's mind as they grow later in life to think about what their legacy will be. And certainly there was great concern about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And the thinking is now, looking back in retrospect, when you think about the fights that the Republicans and Democrats had, people look back and say, well, perhaps Justice Ginsburg should have retired much earlier. And I also want to address something that this view about the justices being political. You're absolutely correct, Rob, that Justice Breyer, you know, shied away from that. And if you look at his actual voting while on the court, typically, he is lumped in to be one of the three liberals still on the court. But of those, he was always considered to be the moderate liberal. And so that is also striking about Breyer's decision to step down right now.
I want to talk a little bit about Justice Breyer's term on the court. A lot of the write-ups, the analysts looking at this say he was somebody who worked to try to build consensus when he could, to negotiate with judges across the ideological boundaries. Do you think that's an accurate read?
It absolutely is, and it's empirically proven scientifically, you know, that if you look at his voting behavior, he was perhaps a bit more conservative compared to other Democratic appointees. He tended to have the smallest percentage of liberal votes, voting, you know, regularly with Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, but compared to their voting records, certainly you could not say that he was more liberal than them. And he voted, for example, with the majority to allow the police to take DNA samples from people arrested. He has weighed in on any number of issues with a balanced perspective, is how I think people will look at Justice Breyer's legacy.
One thing that struck me yesterday, we had a pollster, Charles Franklin, on, a Wisconsin pollster, who had shared some of his numbers about what people think of individual Supreme Court justices. Justice Breyer stood out as the person the justice that people knew the least about. The most people said, I don't know enough about him to have an opinion one way or the other. Does that mean something?
Yeah. Only 20% of Americans said they were able to express an opinion about him. That's certainly not something you could have said about Justice Ginsburg or Justice Scalia. It is striking that he stayed below the radar. What he's also known for being on the court, is being one of the court's intellectuals, often asking questions that seemingly annoyed justices, other justices, because they seemed very intellectual and sometimes, you know, letting the debate drawing in. So it was really just him arguing with whoever the counsel was, arguing the case before the court. So I think that while many of the people appearing before the court are very aware of Breyer, it is clear that people outside the court may not even know he was on the court.
Talking to Kimmy King, professor, interim chair of the Political Science Department at the University of North Texas, one of our go-to Supreme Court watchers here on Central Time, talking about the retirement, the announced retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer, and the confirmation process with the nomination and then confirmation process coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this, your questions, your hopes, your fears. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy, we have President Biden saying he's going to appoint a black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you talk about the significance of that?
Well, it is important, and I think President Biden is also coming to terms with some of his own legacy that he have to deal with. He has to deal with. Remember that he oversaw the nomination of Supreme Court Justice Thomas to the bench, and the allegations made by Anita Hill, a black woman, that Thomas had harassed her, really pivoted everyone to what we look back and say the combination of that and a record number of women being elected to Congress claimed 1992 was the year of the woman. And so I think Biden has tried to rehabilitate some of his image that comes from those days, because it was clearly marked by the allegations that the committee was behaving in a racist manner and that black women would not get a fair hearing in front of the U.S. Congress. So that's no doubt playing part of where he's going. It's also an endeavor. Every president also looks to see what his legacy may be. And this in part allows him to create that legacy in much the same way that former President Obama was trying to recognize a changing society with his nomination of Sonia Sotomayor, the first Latina, to the Supreme Court.
There's been some criticism from Republicans along the lines of just pick the most qualified justice, don't go for a demographic. Others have pointed out that Ronald Reagan, coming into office, promised to appoint, said he was going to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court, who ended up being Sandra Day O'Connor. Do we have precedent for this kind of thing?
Absolutely. In fact, going back in time, you have seen different people say that there needed to be, and going back quite some time, a Jewish representative on the court. That there was a time when we had not seen anyone like that. And so I think that it's something that every president looks to. You also see that presidents talk about having different perspectives and ideological perspective that they want to see on the court. I think what President Biden will need to do as he moves forward, he tried to lay the groundwork a little bit yesterday by coming out swinging that he's going to choose the most qualified person for it. And that person is also going to be a woman, you know, a black woman. It's pretty clear that he recognizes he is going to have a bit of a challenge on this.
Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas. We're looking at the retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer and the upcoming nomination and confirmation process. You can join in 800-642-1234. What are you hoping for from the nominee to replace Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court, whoever that might be? Are there issues where you want to know what a nominee for the Supreme Court thinks about it? What issues are those? What are your hopes for the confirmation process and how it's going to play out in the Senate? Do you have questions about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with University of North Texas political scientist Kimmy King about the retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, officially announced yesterday to happen at the end of his term later this year. Now a nomination and confirmation process will kick off. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions about how all this works. If you're on one side or the other, do you want to see this be a big process, a big debate in the Senate, or do you want to see smooth sailing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Kurt is with us in Milton. Kurt, hi.
Hello. Hey, you know, I also didn't know anything about Justice Breyer, and you know, maybe that's good. What you've said about him is really encouraging. So my observation on this is that I also think it's very good to have women represented and ethnic, you know, representation on the court. But I think that this announcement is not good. It makes it seem like a political thing, like this is a prerequisite. I think that it should be a tiebreaker. He should pick the best person that he wants, and then if you can't decide, then the female and the, you know, genetic makeup might be a tiebreaker.
Gotcha. Kurt, thanks for the call. Kimmy, what do you think about President Biden not doing what Kurt said, just putting that right on the table right off the bat?
So what's really interesting about the good points that your caller, you know, is making is that the nomination of judges and justices has always been political. In fact, going back to the reason why we even have judicial review today, Marbury v. Madison in 1803 was really fundamentally about a battle between the two parties at the time regarding the power of the president to be able to turn down appointments that potentially had been put forward by a prior president. And in terms of the issue, so it's always been political. It's just that it's become even more politicized and polarized as we've become more politicized as a society. In terms of an equal factor, that's exactly where, if you look at equal protection law, there's this, it depends on the area, whether it's employment or higher education. You cannot have a kind of quota, a numerical, you get it just because. It has to be a holistic review, or it's that otherwise equally qualified. And so you're going to have the qualifications to be there in the first place. I would point out, interestingly enough, that when they talked about Amy Coney Barrett and her nomination process and the fact that she came from Notre Dame, she was in some ways non-traditional if you looked at other justices who've been on the court, who have been from Ivy Leagues. And there was actually consternation in some ways that she was outside of the box. So as we look at these candidates, Biden and his team are going to be looking at a whole bunch of different things, including how they're going to get it through a divided Senate 50-50 without having to force the issue of having Kamala Harris, you know, do the tie-breaking vote. And so it is going to be, without a doubt, the same issues that get raised as we go through this confirmation process that your caller is raising.
Kurt, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about that confirmation process now. The filibuster, where, you know, you need 60 votes to do things in the Senate, no longer applies, right, to Supreme Court justices. That's how Republicans were able to get a few nominees through over the President Trump's term. So how hard do you think it's going to be for Democrats to get 50 and maybe one more, or get that tiebreaker?
So, you know, what it really boils down to, and you've seen this with the concern about Senators Manchin and Sinema, who, you know, conservative Democrats who've helped to, they've assisted the Republicans in essentially blocking Biden's agenda in some ways. One of the things about nominating someone that has already been through the federal court nomination process, whether they've been a district court judge or an appellate court judge, the president can look to that and say, hey, Sinema and Manchin, you supported this person at the lower court levels. Why is it now when we're going to the Supreme Court, she is no longer qualified to serve? And it puts some of the onus back on people that might be opposed to a candidate he puts forward. And so I think Biden's going to weigh that heavily. And quite honestly, I think that that is going to overshadow everything that he does.
There was a lot of attention to, like, the Build Back Better Act. You mentioned Senators Manchin and Sinema not getting on board to overcome the filibuster on that. How have Democrats held together, though, on all those other court appointments? And there have been a lot of them, right?
Actually, what's striking about Sinema and Manchin, that if you look at their support for Biden's lower court nominees, they have not opposed a single one. And so that's definitely something that everybody is looking to, and why the people on President Biden's shortlist are thought, in some ways, the top candidates where they are placed. And it's because of having that prior support. And you've even seen in Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the fact that she has district court and court of appeal approval and had some Republican support even at the lowest court level. So that's going to be another issue even to go after Republicans on.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about Justice Stephen Breyer's retirement announcement this week and the upcoming process to replace him. You dropped one name there, Kimmy. Can you talk about who people's eyes are on right now as possible nominees?
So in my mind, the person that is out front the most and is getting the most attention is Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was confirmed last year to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And the reason why the D.C. Circuit is so important is it's considered to be one of the most powerful appellate courts in the country. She also has a history as a former public defender. That, too, would make her different from some of the other people who have been appointed to a Supreme Court justice. Strikingly about Brown Jackson, it offers an opportunity to kind of get a kind of payback a little bit, because she replaced the now Attorney General Merrick Garland, who you may remember was a failed attempt on the part of the Obama administration to try to get him appointed. And so she actually replaced him on the D.C. Circuit. And so people are looking at her because she's already been involved in a case involving, say, for example, the White House documents that they should be released to the Congressional Committee reviewing January 6th. And so it's thought that she's kind of proved some of her governmental capacity there for recognizing support for policies that the Biden administration supports. And every president tries to put judges or justices on the bench that they think will fulfill their legacy. And you saw that even with former President Trump being unhappy about some decisions that came out of judges and justices themselves, that he felt he deserved more support from them because he had been responsible for their appointments. And that's not how it works. Just because Biden puts whoever this is on the bench, that is absolutely no guarantee that they are going to back the president's policies, as presidents have learned all too well in difficult times.
Even supposing that President Biden nominates someone, they get confirmed that they're more or less reliably liberal on the court. In the near term, how much difference does that make with the, to be crass, 6-3 conservative majority?
Yeah, really not clear. What does this make any difference at all? And here's where it gets interesting, that justices themselves can change over the life of their vote, or they may turn out to not be the justice that the president hoped that they would be. And you have seen out of Justice Gorsuch and out of Chief Justice Roberts, they have departed from their conservative colleagues. What's striking about Breyer leaving the court is that he did have a little bit of an ability to cobble together, it seems, we don't know really the inner workings of the court, to kind of moderate more some of these schisms between conservatives and liberals. And that's why he did not like those labels and thought that they were worthless for looking at the court. But in terms of actually making changes on the ground for where we are right now and cases that are pending in the court or might be up next year, it's not clear that it makes any difference at all.
In our last minute or so, Kimmy, Justice Breyer is still on the court. There's some big issues before the court. We're waiting for decisions or about to hit the court. What do you have your eye on in particular?
Oh, gosh. There are so many different ones. I think the one that everybody is watching, that everybody is going to be talking out, are going to be the abortion cases that are out there right now. I'm down in Texas, but we've also got a case out of Mississippi that everyone is watching very closely. Any issue related to immigration, all the things that are big picture right now, right? You're going to want to watch because Democrats are going to use it to say, see, this is why you need to leave us in power. We need to change the balance of power on the court moving forward. So those hot issues, abortion, immigration, criminal procedure has been one of those as well in the past, but it doesn't seem to be playing such a dominant role right now. And then, of course, there may be cases that are coming up that relate to former President Trump and any level of litigation that's currently moving through the courts relating to him. Those are all going to be ones that potentially have the ability to leave a mark on Breyer's legacy if he doesn't sort of make statements as he's going out the door about what he thinks about these issues.
Kimmy, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Always good to be a part of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to talk to you, Rob.
You too. That's Kimmy King, professor and interim chair of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at the latest on the Supreme Court. Monday on Central Time, a Wisconsin doctor makes the case for gun locks at home. That's Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we're all awkward sometimes, and we'll find out why it might be better to embrace those cringe-inducing moments rather than trying to avoid them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll get some inspiration from the Mediterranean with the author of a Greek-American cookbook. Spoiler alert, stock up on lemons and olive oil. First, a growing section of the internet is becoming more and more interested in the idea of cringe, that feeling of discomfort you feel when you see someone experiencing embarrassment or awkwardness. But everyone experiences awkwardness at some point in our lives, and there are no simple rules on how not to be cringy. Our next guest says we need to embrace our awkwardness. She thinks it can be good for us, and she took it for a test drive. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an awkward story you're willing to share? I understand if no one wants to call in and share those awkward moments, it's hard. But if you're willing, love to hear from you. Do you feel like you're an awkward person in general or were at some point in your life, like my junior high season? Do you embrace your awkwardness? Do you have a question about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melissa Dahl is author of the book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. She's the executive health director at Bustle Digital Group and from Wisconsin. Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I am from Wisconsin, yes.
Your book came out a few years ago, and we didn't notice it at the time. I'm sorry, a producer saw it referenced in a recent article. We love the topic. I hope it's not awkward that we didn't catch it the first time around.
It's incredibly awkward. No, which is perfect.
Now, you have an origin story to your awkwardness. Can you tell us a little bit about why this is such a central topic in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say I kind of like set out to, I got interested in a topic because I've always sort of felt a little bit out of place. I'm originally from Wisconsin, but then we moved around a lot and, just always kind of like you know, inserting myself into a new school and trying to figure out like the little social norms and stuff. And that feeling always kind of stayed with me. I don't think that's, you know, unique to me. I think everybody probably at some point or another feels a little out of place. But I set out initially, my whole pitch for the book was to, you know, create like a guide, an anti-awkwardness guide, you know, like do these exact like 10 steps and you will never feel this way again. And I just kind of came away like not really wanting to get rid of the feeling, weirdly. So
let's talk about what it means to be awkward. And you give a definition kind of where our self-image collides with what the rest of the world is seeing at this moment.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think it is. I think it's like you are intending to present yourself to the world in a particular way, and it is just not happening. It is just not how people are actually seeing you. And when you are, you know, you might be blissfully unaware of that fact, but like when you become aware of that gap between the you you're trying to present and the you the world is actually seeing, that's where I think the kind of the that cringy feeling comes in. And it happens for other people too. I think that's what, you know, why we cringe at people doing like embarrassing things on the internet. We can see what they're aiming for and we can see how far away they really are. So, yeah.
Yeah. How did the internet change this? Cause I could think of, you know, back in high school, I was in this band of kids. We played, you know, pop songs, and this is not the like hyper talented kids from Fame. Okay. We had our talents, but I'm super glad there's no video still in existence of this. Wow. And to think that now on the internet, the me of today could like be embarrassed in front of like millions or billions of people. That really ups the ante for awkwardness, right?
I know. I mean, like, I feel like I just escaped it. Like the internet kind of became what it is now. Like, I got a Facebook in college, but I was just on TikTok the other day and I saw a girl who said something like, in middle school, my crush said, you know, he really liked French girls. So I posted this on my Instagram. This is like really embarrassing photo of her in a beret, you know, trying to look all cute. And yeah, the generation just younger than me, like, is kind of haunted by their past selves online. So they better find a way to make peace with that, I think.
We've got a brave caller at 800-642-1234 who has a story. Colin is in Viroqua. Colin, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story for us?
Well, yesterday at my work at lunchtime, I was eating a bowl of ramen noodle soup. And I kind of inhaled and coughed at the same time, and the darn noodle came out my nose right at the lunchroom table.
Oh, no.
And it was just nothing you could do about it.
And there were other people around, I'm guessing?
Yes, it was awful. I wish I could crawl under a rock.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you've recovered, though. Did you just say, yeah, I'm okay? How did you bounce back from that?
Well, I just grabbed a napkin and, you know, blew my nose and said, oh, my God, senioritis, what can I help?
I mean, it could happen to anybody. Colin, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, in that moment, Melissa, you know, if this happened in a room by ourselves, gross, but no big deal. But I think we've all, you know, this is Wisconsin, you fall on the ice or something.
Yeah.
I'm okay. You're not sure if you're okay, but you just don't want to be the center of attention in that moment. Did you learn lessons in researching your book about how to, as gracefully as possible, come out of that moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think all you have to do, I know this just sounds like really, you know, I spent like a year researching this to come to like what kind of ends up being a little bit obvious information or advice, but you just, there's nothing to do except for like find the humor in it. Like I started to see these moments as just like little cracks in the facade, you know, like we're all like trying to just be these like competent together people. And then something like that happens and just reveals like, no, we are all dorks, you know? what really did help me is just like the interconnectedness of this feeling. Like it wouldn't be embarrassing, like you said, if you were in a room by yourself. So these moments like kind of connect us to other people. There's something kind of nice about that after you've maybe, you know, blown your nose and recovered.
Thanks again for sharing that story, Colin, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Melissa Dahl, author of the book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness from a couple years back. You can join in if you have an awkward moment you're willing to share how you got through it at 800-642-1234. Did you have an awkward moment end up on the internet? 800-642-1234 is the number. Melissa, as part of your research for your book, you actually sought out situations that were kind of built in to be awkward, sometimes up on stage in front of other people. Can you share some of the things you did to personally cultivate your awkwardness?
Yeah, I mean, I opened the book kind of doing like the most terrifying thing I could think of. There's this stage show called Mortified. They're all across the country, and it's like adults who read from their teenage journals, their teenage diaries, and they're very helpful. The producers help you make a little like story out of it, and it is so funny as an audience member, and it is so terrifying as a performer. But yeah, I read from my middle school journal about how I was just desperately in love with the boy band Hanson. So,
and that's another part of your story, moving from place to place, that I've read. Loving Hanson in one school was super cool, and you knew you were cool when you're putting that Hanson poster up in your locker in the next school. But what happened?
Oh, the next school, it was just the dorkiest thing you could do. Like, you know, oh my God, like that's just, no one likes that. Like, oh, like, you know, who's this girl? So yeah, just like those little social norms that you just can't pick up until you kind of break one.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us in Burlington. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Good. What's your story, Valerie?
We were having a sleepover at a girlfriend's house when I was a teenager. We were staying out in her camper, and my mom, we decided it was a good idea to flash cars that were driving by.
Uh-oh.
So the next morning, my mom asked what we did at the sleepover, and of course I said, you know, we had a bonfire, we ate hot dogs, we had s'mores. She goes, no, really. What did you do? And I'm like, what do you mean? Well, she had a phone call that night telling her of my, proclivities, I guess. Yeah. So, and she went to her deathbed, holding on to that secret. So I see my old neighbors and things like that, and I cringe because I'm wondering which one of them told on me.
Oh, wow, Valerie. Thank you for being willing to share that with us. Wow. And that's, I don't know, maybe moving around isn't so bad, Melissa, because you can get away from the people who know the secrets about you.
Yep, that's my advice. You got to move. You got to go.
Valerie, thank you for sharing that with us. We are talking about life's awkward moments with Melissa Dahl, author of the book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. You can join in if you're willing at 800-642-1234. If you have a cringy story you can share, do you seek these kind of awkward videos out on the internet? Are you a fan of the shows like The Office, especially the old British Office, or the Curb Your Enthusiasm, or just, you know, that kind of comedy show that really lives and breathes those awkward moments? I had to stop watching them, to be honest. I couldn't take it anymore. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about awkwardness with author Melissa Dahl. She wrote the book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a story to share about an awkward moment in your life. If you find awkward, cringy videos on the internet or those kind of TV shows, awkward or fun to watch, a little bit of both, call 800-642-1234. Back to your surprisingly many calls. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, so I'm 42 now. I was 40 at the time. I thought during COVID I'd pull out my Trek mountain bike and, you know, go start biking around since I had so much time on my hands. And I was riding down Oklahoma rather at a fast pace, and I tried to avoid a puddle in the crosswalk and just totally bit it into a big puddle. And it was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There's plenty of cars around. So I totally wiped out. The only thing I could do was to pop up, brush myself off, put up my arm and yell, I'm okay, and then hop on and pedal like hell.
Marcus, well, I'm glad, first of all, you were physically unharmed, it sounds like. Obviously 2 years later, the moment sticks with you.
Yeah, it was more my pride was hurt.
My pride was hurt. Marcus, that sums it up greatly. My pride was hurt, Melissa. That's what a lot of these awkward moments are about, isn't it?
It really is. It's so interesting, too, that, like, why is getting hurt? Why would that be embarrassing? Like, why do we have that reaction? Like, if you fall, that is the first thing you say. Like, I'm okay, even if you're, like, obviously bleeding.
Theismaning, yeah. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Melissa, I'm kind of surprised. We have full phone lines here. We'll go back to our callers in a minute. I didn't know if anybody would call. Did you get that when you came out with a book and or said, yeah, I'm writing a book about awkwardness? Did people want to volunteer their awkward moments to you?
Yes, 1,000%. Like the second someone like told me or the second I told someone what the book was about, they're like, oh, my gosh, you have to like, you know, you like, are you writing my life story? You have to include this in the book. You know, this happened. It just kind of comes back to me that like, I guess I approached this little weird little emotion that drove me crazy as this like really isolating feeling. But in the end, I just really came to think of it as this like thing that connects us. We're all just big dorks who just kind of mess up and, you know, do embarrassing things. And there's just something really lovely about it. So, yeah.
That's cool. Thanks for sharing that with us, Marcus, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Rick is with us in Eau Claire. Rick, hi.
Yes, I have a story about when I worked in a factory. One of my coworkers accidentally cut one of his fingers off.
Ooh.
And it was horrible, but they took him to the hospital and they fixed him up and they brought him back. And the supervisor said to him, how did you do that? And he said, well, like this. And he cut the next finger off.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And the takeaway that I got from that was we had a series of directions that we were supposed to follow running this saw, and he didn't follow the directions. But it was very – it's just kind of a horrible experience. But it taught me, follow directions.
Rick, I guess so. Thanks for sharing that. I think this one goes a little beyond awkward, Melissa. I hope the guy's okay. I don't know. But I guess
am cringing, though.
I am cringing, too. So that yeah. Fits. I don't know. Do you have life lessons in awkwardness, Melissa, where we can learn from our mistakes or learn from those of others, I guess, if we want a moral to Rick's story?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, you know, here's the moral. I am finding myself, like, actually, you know, cringing. And here's a fun fact. Like, I guess there's some neuroscientists in Germany who are actually studying what happens in the brain when we kind of experience cringy moments. And it is right where the brain processes pain. So, so yeah.
Thanks. Related. Thanks for sharing that story. And I think it was in your book I saw there's kind of maybe even universal cringe responses of our body posture and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, that is the takeaway I got from this this very, I don't even know how I came across this, but this anthropological report from like the 50s where this guy kind of visited island where no, you know, Westerners had been, and they'd never like seen what they looked like in a mirror or on a camera or anything. And when they were shown, when he took Polaroids of them, and, you know, he like, you know, gave them mirrors, and when they saw their reflections, when they saw what they looked like, they kind of just like they like covered their face with their hand or kind of like cowered, you know, which is like exactly what I do when I'm experiencing an awkward moment. So it's just so interesting that like it's a little bit of a fear response, I think. It's even for someone who's never seen that on another person before.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Talking to Melissa Dahl, she's the author of the book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. Back to your awkward stories at 800-642-1234 with Tom and Rhinelander. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Tom?
Well, until last year when I retired, I worked at the local county courthouse in Oneida County. And one nice spring day, I walked out wearing dress clothes and dress shoes and looked up at the blue sky and walked right through freshly poured wet cement.
Oh, no.
The guys were troweling it right next to me. I don't know how I didn't see them. I was so embarrassed. I felt so bad. And they were so nice about it. They had a hose and they hosed my shoes off and I went home for lunch. And then when I came back, I went into the buildings and grounds department and had them bring it up on the security video. And I videoed that video with my camera and put it out on Facebook so all my friends could have a laugh. And So I think the message for me was you have to be able to laugh at yourself.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing that. And Melissa, that's kind of one of my takeaways from you. Like, we need to be willing to not take ourselves too seriously in these moments.
Yeah, you just have to kind of lighten up and I think as quickly as possible, turn it into a story. And it sounds like you did that very quickly by sharing it on your Facebook. That's very brave of you.
Tom, thanks for sharing that with us. Nancy is with us in Rusk County. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a bad story. I was in a hotel at a conference in Atlanta, Georgia, ordered room service in my bedroom, got dressed in a very nice nightgown, and went to put my tray outside the door, and the door slammed shut, and uh-oh, there I was in the hallway in this nightgown. Oh,
no. So what do you do in that situation, Nancy?
I didn't know what I was going to do. I stood there for a minute. I knew I couldn't go downstairs in that nightgown and get a key. And so down the hall, I heard the elevator open, and it was a guy coming down the hallway. And I said, "Sir, can you help?"
Oh, Nancy's line cut out there. Bedroom. I think. Oh, there you go.
Oh, did you hear that?
So you got a good Samaritan help you out, is what it sounded like?
Well, he gave me his sport coat, and he went downstairs and brought up a guy from the front desk, and who opened my bedroom door, and I could get back into my bedroom.
Fantastic, Nancy. I'm glad you had a happy ending there. Melissa, can you talk about maybe what you learned about giving grace and helping out that other person in the awkward situation? When it's not us, it's them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's kind of two ways to respond to someone else's, you know, cringy moment. You can kind of respond with a little bit of scorn, and that kind of like separates yourself from that other person. Like, oh, that would never happen to me. You know, that I would never be in that situation. Or you can respond with compassion and just realize like, yeah, you absolutely could be and probably will be soon in that a similar situation. So I've tried to choose as often as possible to just respond with a, you know, a kind of a compassionate cringing, and realizing that, like, you know, this person, actually something really similar did happen to me.
Oh, no.
Talking about this, when I first moved into this apartment, I have a big patio, and I was out on the patio in my like robe and like slippers, and I locked myself out there and had to call my super to let me back in.
Well, you had your phone anyway, so that's okay.
Yeah, I did. Thank God. Yeah. So yeah.
Thanks again for sharing that story, Nancy. Melissa, we've just got a minute or two left here. You ultimately, if I'm reading you right, came to think of awkwardness as not totally a negative thing. How can we view it as a positive in our lives?
I mean, I think that all of these people who are so eager to share their stories with, like, Wisconsin Public Radio are an example of just doing that naturally. Like, it's like we go through this stuff and we survive it, and then we use it to just, like, relate to people and connect to people. And it's even in the moment, like, the embarrassment, it means it's embarrassing because we're afraid that it's like kind of like severing a connection to people, that we're just like, oh, we're just going to be, you know, just a social reject, you know, but that's really not what happens. You can kind of use those moments to relate to people and to connect to people. So once you have, you know, recovered. So,
and before I let you go, Melissa, I mentioned earlier cringe as entertainment, you know, videos of real people or TV shows that use that awkwardness as their main sense of humor. Having gone through writing this book, do you seek that out? Do you watch it? Do you find it entertaining, or do you steer clear of that cringe entertainment?
Oh gosh. I have kind of since the book given myself a little bit of a break from it. It really feels like a social horror movies, you know, like it's just, I also had to stop watching Curb Your Enthusiasm. So yeah.
Melissa, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's been fun.
That's Melissa Dahl, author of the book Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness, executive health director at Bustle Digital Group, with us today to talk about what makes us cringe, what causes awkwardness, and how we can embrace it. You can keep sharing your stories. A lot of you have stories to share. You can email, if you'd like, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or if you could tell it briefly, tweet us @Central Time WPR.